Investors Chronicle.
Welcome to the Companies and Markets Show. I'm Dan Jones. It's Thursday, the 2nd of March. Slap bang in the middle of results season. It's another very busy day on the corporate reporting front. And yet we have dragged away a couple of our companies writers and our ideas editor to chew the fat with us today. So let's get into it without further ado. Joining me today, we have Gemma Slingo.
Hi, Dan.
Mitchell Labiak.
Hi, Dan.
And over the lines with a special microphone at home, Alex Newman. Hi, Alex.
Also, hello, Dan.
Excellent. As is, well, I would say traditional, but we've only just started doing it this way. We're going to get straight into things today by talking about ITV with Gemma. And then we're going to talk about our cover feature this week, which is on what to do with a lump sum, if you are fortunate enough to have one and wonder what best way you can invest it or use it in other ways. Alex will be talking about that. And then we're going to talk about Persimmon, which had some pretty gloomy results, even in the context of a gloomy housing market this week. But we'll start with ITV. Gemma, results, full year results out today. Kind of as you'd expect in some ways, i.e. saying it's going to be a more difficult year to come, which is the case for most companies in the UK market, I expect. But there's various interesting points that we can get into. But let's start with what we learned today from those figures at a headline level, both in terms of how the business has been doing last year and what it thinks is going to happen over the months ahead.
It wasn't a dazzling set of results, I wouldn't say. Total advertising revenue was down by about 1%. And I think the general trend was, as the year went on, things got increasingly tricky. But I always think it's important to remember with ITV that it's basically a business of two halves. So you've got the side of things that everyone's familiar with, broadcasting, news, new programmes, that sort of thing. But it also has a studios division, which makes television programmes not just for ITV, but for other broadcasters and streamers. So it always surprises me when I'm reading about ITV that it actually makes programmes for the BBC sometimes, as well as international companies. So that side of the business actually looks pretty robust. So you had some nice revenue growth, good profits, and actually things still seem to be moving in the right direction. It's more the advertising side of things that are getting a bit tricky, even though it did hold up fairly well this year. I think this current quarter that we're in is meant to be quite difficult, with revenues predicted to be down by about 11%, which shareholders probably won't be thrilled to hear about.
Yeah, this is obviously on the traditional side of the business, dragging it down somewhat, you might say, insofar as those revenues. I think advertising revenue as a whole was down 1% last year, but digital revenue was up 17%. And it's a similar story this year. It looks like the first quarter they expect digital revenue to be up 25%, but overall advertising revenue to be down by about 10%. Digital revenues are still, we're looking at about 350 million versus 2 billion for advertising overall. So a small part, or a smaller part of the pie, but something that is clearly growing much quicker than the traditional side, as you'd expect. And a lot of that is based on ITVX, or some of that is based on ITVX, which is the new ITV hub, the player, which ITV have invested a lot of money in and have quite high hopes for. And, you know, they've said that's got off to a pretty good start.
Yeah, it looks like it. I mean, when it was first announced, a lot of people were saying, well, this should have happened 10 years ago. But it's good that it's finally happening now. So they've sort of upgraded the platform, so it should be more user-friendly. And they've ploughed loads of money into new programmes. And it does seem people have responded fairly well. So monthly active users were up by about 6%, and people seem to be watching more programmes than they did before. So that's positive, but I think this coming year will probably be when we see if all that money they've spent really was worth it, and whether investors start seeing good returns on it, really.
I was looking at some of those comments from ITV about, you know, the growth year on year in engagement, and it does seem, you know, they wisely launched ITVX just before the World Cup at the end of last year. So, you know, some of those year on year comparisons are going to be quite flattered by the fact there was a football tournament that a lot of people were watching ITV than they wouldn't necessarily be watching ITV otherwise.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. But they must be feeling confident, I think, because they're still planning to spend over £1 billion on new shows in 2023. So if it was a completely disastrous flop, I don't think they'd still be doing that, really.
Mm.
So they must think the demand's still there.
Can you rewind on ITVX yet? That was my big bugbear during the World Cup.
Unclear, it seems. Yeah. I've had different experiences, different times I've used it, so
yeah.
No comment.
I think they've said they will continue to add functionality this year, which hopefully includes that. It just that struck me, you know, as the contrast with iPlayer during the tournament, where you could cycle back a few minutes on iPlayer, but you can't on ITV. But you know, as long as the advertising revenues keep coming in and the user experience is tolerable, that should work well enough. But let's talk about ITV Studios a bit more, which you mentioned there. You know, in some ways the hidden asset, increasingly not so hidden, but certainly, you know, there's value to be unlocked there, perhaps, which we'll come on to in a minute. But also, it's definitely a business that's still flourishing in many ways. You know, growth was strong last year, and there's lots of plans for this year as well.
It seems to be, and I think when you're looking at the business, you have to remember that actually all those programmes form a really valuable library of intellectual property, which isn't necessarily embedded into the valuation. I think just because it's not as visible to the consumer, people do have a tendency to forget about it.
Yeah, as you say as well, the kinds of programmes it makes, they're not just for ITV, you know, it's had, I think, the rights to Line of Duty before, which is something you wrote about when we included ITV as an idea back in November. You know, it makes programmes for Apple and, you know, the big streamers as well. So it's not just a UK concern. And, of course, ITV as well has its reality TV or scripted reality, whatever they call it nowadays, shows that are pretty successful, you know, be they Love Island, be they new shows that it's selling this year, one of which is called My Mum, Your Dad, which is apparently getting a load of teenagers to get their single parents into a house and try to matchmake them, which, you know, sounds like the kind of thing that could be a roaring success. I have no idea, but apparently it's sold to multiple different countries. But the point is that ITV Studios does have, you know, it's not just ITV content and it's not just drama and reality. It's kind of a mix of everything, really.
Yeah, and I think that's basically, maybe not that show you mentioned, but the general theme is why I put it on a buy. I think it was back in November, because the basic sense I got was that whole side, the studio side, does seem undervalued compared to peers you see elsewhere in Europe. And one analyst I spoke to basically said, well, in the current valuation, you're not just getting the broadcasting side for free. It's actually a negative value. So hopefully that should eventually sort of rectify itself. And as the economic backdrop gets a bit more favourable, ad sales hopefully start going up again. That could push shares in the right direction.
Yeah, I think ITV were referring to this year as an inflection point, which is a nice way of saying it's going to be a tough year, but then we're really well set for 2024 onwards. Alex, I think you had some thoughts about ITV's ability to unlock value, maybe with ITV Studios, and possibly just on the valuation case as well.
Yeah, so a bit of a spitballing, but this week, you know, elsewhere in markets, is one of the big subjects for London has been the sort of mini exodus of big businesses which are planning on either doing a secondary listing or moving their primary listing to the US to get a bigger bigger valuation, more liquid investor pool. I mean, I think incidentally ITV is one FTSE 100 constituent which probably would have a higher valuation if it were listed in the US. I mean, its enterprise value is about 5 times cash profits, and you look at not precise comparables, but companies like Comcast or Fox or Warner Brothers in the US, and they're more like on sort of 7 times. I mean, the obvious stumbling block here is that it's a UK domestic stock with, I suppose, limited brand recognition in the US. But I think there's a really, really big but to that, which I'll come to. I mean, the big question for investors, you know, with the ITVX spending is obviously around higher CapEx, and that not only is that kind of an uncertain bet, but it has the effect of suppressing free cash flow. And on ITVX, I think, you know, my take looking at the results is it might be a little bit too early to say anything there about the success. But the other thing that really jumped out of these numbers, I think there's really, there's some good evidence here that one big investment they have been making really is paying off. So revenue from ITV Studios US, which is their studios division that's focused on the US market, was up 26% last year, which is huge. And even if you strip out the effect of the dollar, it was up 13%. And they think there are loads of growth prospects there. So it's now around a quarter of sales in their biggest division. And that's the largest, as we've said, the studios is the largest source of growth in the business. I don't think at all it's a wild stretch to make the argument which Gemma did when she cited the analyst valuation or the breakup valuation of the studios business, that it's kind of in the price for free, or that it would be valued at about 75p per share on its own. And so, if you look at it, kind of compound these numbers and look forward a couple of years, then you have a really promising US business there, which, not necessarily a secondary listing for ITV, but it's the sort of thing that could be a potential takeover target and actually realize quite a lot of value that we really discount from media businesses because of all the struggles they have with advertising. So yeah, those are my sort of, it's my deep conjecture for the week, but I thought it was quite an interesting set of results from ITV actually.
Yeah. You can see in the sort of coverage of the results already, people do like to focus on, the headline ad revenue, falling television revenue. And, as we've touched on, the amounts that they have to invest in content, it's over a billion a year and rising. But I think, these facets to the business show there is something else there that perhaps isn't fully recognised. So, yes, it will be another one to watch for the year ahead. Alex, we'll keep you on the line because you've written the cover story this week, which is on lump sum investing. And it's in some ways a philosophical look, but also a practical look at what to do with a lump sum, which, everyone, as you say in the piece, has idle dreams of, the lottery, the Euro Millions, those kind of things. But in reality, whether we recognise it or not, most of us, or certainly many of us, will come into some kind of lump sum at some point in our lives. So it's a question worth considering for a lot of people, whoever they are.
Yeah, and I mean, this wasn't my intention with it, but I suppose the timing of the piece is useful because, we're in the middle of bonus season for lots of companies. If you work for a company, ISA season's also upon us as well. And the stats from HMRC suggest that we're heading toward a record-breaking year for inheritance tax receipts. So, there's sort of implications around that. That not only means that, the state's take is likely to increase, but the incentives to pass on or liquidate estates without incurring very heavy duties are likely to increase. And that could mean that there are more gifts, within families. It's obviously a very nice position to be in. And at any one time, most people aren't in the position to have a lump sum to use. But, the odds of it happening in the course of a life, as you mentioned, aren't slim. And they certainly are a lot higher than the chance of winning the lottery. So, it's a sensible thing to plan for. And if you haven't planned for it and might feel a bit lost when it comes to the question of how you might approach using it, we've written this piece for you.
And when you're starting out on thinking about this kind of thing, once you get over the initial elation, or as you say in the piece, sometimes it's not necessarily elation, certainly if it comes via inheritance, there can be mixed feelings there. But when it comes to the practical side of things, the basics, more so perhaps with a lump sum than with general investment goals when you're, drip feeding in, which we can come to. But the basics are very much about establishing a goal, establishing what you want to do, and then establishing your attitude to risk tolerance, things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And should say at the start of this, none of what we're saying here should constitute financial planning advice. There are thousands of professionals out there to advise you properly on those questions. But trying to set a goal is I think a smart idea. I was looking at some of the research on what people end up using lump sums or family inheritances was the proxy the researchers looked at, And something like, so it's a study of US families, and something like half of it goes on spending and lost money in investments, while the other half is saved. So, you know, some of that spending might be entirely what, you know, people want to do with the money. And you know, if you get a lump sum, you can obviously look at what you want the money to do for you in priorities you might not have considered before. You know, one question that came up in speaking to some financial planners for people who might have children is, you know, if you maybe previously hadn't considered it, thinking about private education. That's not a comment or recommendation on private education in any way. That's just a reality for some families to consider that. So you know, a lump sum in and of itself isn't an invitation to a certain type of investment or investing at all necessarily. There are you know, the goal is the more important thing to start with. And then, you know, some very sensible sort of first points to look at are things like, you know, have you got a rainy day fund? Can you use some of the cash to set aside for that? Do you have some high interest debts that you might like to clear? Do you have some lower interest debts you might like to clear, just because there's a psychological benefit, if not necessarily a long-term financial rationale in the sort of optimized sense of using your money? So yeah, there are a few, you know, kind of like checklists you might do to begin with before you even consider deploying it into the kind of financial assets we talk about on this program.
Yeah, let's talk about the way in which it is actually invested, assuming that some of this money is going to be invested. Drip feeding is obviously a common way for people to invest, you know, whether they have a lump sum or not, and that would seem to be best practice here as well, both from an investment point of view and from a taxation point of view. Albeit, you know, I think as someone says in the piece, you know, pound cost averaging is less effective than going all in, given that asset prices tend to rise over time. You know, you can end up missing these things, but the ultimate point is you can't time the market, so drip feeding remains the sensible way to do things.
Yeah, I mean, two kind of big issues here. So the first, let's start with sort of taxation, because it's something that the financial planners I spoke to for this piece sort of bang on a lot about. But I mean, really, the power of tax wrappers when you are investing for most people is enormous. And most people aren't going to have £20,000 a year to max out their ISAs or make full use of their SIP allowances or contribute towards a junior ISA if that's also something they are, you know, investing for. So, you know, we're actually talking about quite a considerable amount of money if you are going to drip feed in the sort of tax allowance sense on a year-to-year basis. The second issue really is around risk and how you, I suppose, how you perceive investing in a market, a large sum of money in one go. For some people, you know, the possibility even that it, you know, markets crash in a month's time after investing is too much to bear. And, you know, if you're going to lose sleep over going all in the market in one go, then, you know, that's not an ideal trade-off, really. I mean, obviously, everyone's different, and some people might be able to tolerate very cold-blooded financial decisions. But you have to make, I suppose, you know, have to make all money work for you in the way that's going to, you know, allow you to sleep at night as well. So for some people, a way of managing a lump sum, if you are going to invest it, and it's way above the levels at which, you know, sort of tax wrapper friendly deployment is going to work, so, you know, sort of in the hundreds of thousands of pounds perhaps, one way might be to put half of it in, or to put 25% in and then put drip, you know, drip feed as you mentioned, amounts over sort of a month or every couple of months basis. So there are ways of splitting up a large cash figure which adjusts for the risk and also helps you if you're a sort of very risk averse person who just can't bear the prospect of just being unlucky, which statistically speaking is quite rare. There are reasons why actually going in all in one is, you know, over the long term is probably smarter, because markets do tend to rise over time. Those are some of the kind of starting points for if this is all kind of a bit mystifying for you, and you're trying to work out your own risk tolerance.
Yeah, as that implies, you know, you have written the piece very much for people at all stages of life, and perhaps, you know, people who wouldn't necessarily read the IC as well, who just come into some money. So, you know, if you are listening to this and you can think of someone like that, or, you know, you think it might be useful for yourselves, do pick it up and have a look. But let's finish this segment by talking about property. Again, there are two strands to this and two things we've written about separately in recent weeks as well, kind of come together in this piece. The first being, mortgage and people considering about whether they should pay off a mortgage if they have one and they come into a lump sum. And secondly, you know, the question of the purchase of property, which historically, of course, certainly in the UK, has been a very popular investment, perhaps now, right now, less so given the outlook for the years ahead and given how difficult some of those investments are proving nowadays.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, to continue our sort of pile-on on buy-to-let investing after Val Cipriani's very good piece the other week on why it's the sort of returns you might expect from that investment are nowhere near as rosy as they might have been sort of 10 years ago. I think the question when it comes to lump sum to sort of fit it in on the question of property, if you inherit £300,000, let's say, or I think there is a natural natural instinct to gravitate to the idea that what can £300,000 in cash buy me? And because in many parts of the UK still, you know, that can get you a property, there is this instinctive lurch, and one financial planner put it to me that, you know, it's regardless of sort of age, financial literacy or other circumstances, there is this kind of lurch towards property because it's tangible. It's been a great investment for several decades. So we have this really inbuilt bias to assuming that it will continue to be so for coming decades. Actually, there are so many risks and downsides and headaches which can come with, you know, the job of being a landlord, which people can overlook. So it's like, you know, the lump sum fitting the size of the investment can sometimes dictate how people feel about money and wanting to have something to show for that money, when actually, you know, a more balanced portfolio approach, I think, is one that lots of financial planners would advocate for, over and above UK property, despite it having worked so well. So that's another, I thought, an important point wanted to make in the piece, because it is the default option for so many people, particularly when it comes to lump sums.
Yeah. Well, on the subject of property, that brings us nicely to our final result of the podcast, which is Persimmon, which was altogether a little more dramatic than ITV in terms of both certainly its guidance, certainly the share price reaction, which is pretty negative. And that's because the results themselves and the outlook, Mitchell, pretty gloomy.
Yeah, I mean, not all angles, but from many angles, it was quite a gloomy set of results. Unsurprisingly, sort of pre-tax profit took a hit even as revenue ticked up, but sort of going forward, that was the sort of, I think, the thing that caught a lot of sort of shareholders' eyes and sort of motivated most people, a lot of people, I think, to sell, was the sort of how things are looking going forward. Forward sales are down, kind of as you would expect, or rather more than I think a lot of people expected. And there doesn't really seem to be much in the results that would imply that it's going to sort of grow sort of anytime soon, at least not in the short or medium term. So I think, I mean, if I was to summarize sort of the bad news, as it were, that would be it, really.
Persimmon was quite explicit and detailed in setting out these scenarios and this bad news to come, even in the context of, you know, the gloom we've seen around the housing market in recent months. Specifically on margins, I think they said as well, operating margin last year was 27%, which fell a bit, but But this year, if you combine higher sales incentives, falling volumes, cost inflation, you know, about 3 to 5 percentage points off the margin potentially from each of those if current sales continue as they had done for the first couple of months of the year. So that means effectively that operating margin could halve if current conditions persist, which is a pretty extreme fall.
Yeah, and I think the sales incentives are really worth keeping an eye on, because this is the stuff like, you know, free fridges and new carpets and stuff that you do to sort of shift homes. And it, in of themselves, you know, an increase in sales incentives is, as you say, it has an impact on the operating margin. But it's also sort of what it signals about the market and its confidence in the product. I think confidence is what was really lacking in those results. I mean, I think, you know, that was where the sort of the headline figure of the dividend cut, you know, it did warn shareholders that it was going to cut the dividend, but I don't think people expected a 75% cut. So there is a degree to which whereas with other house builders, some of the bad news might have already been priced in because of various updates. Persimmon's update did indeed say we're going to cut the dividend, but I don't think people expected a dividend cut by quite that much, and sort of what that therefore implied about sort of its confidence going forward. And when you add that in with sort of the sales incentives increasing, it doesn't look like an overly confident business. So that operating margin speaks to a sort of wider issue of trading going forward.
On pricing for now, I mean, this week we did have it was the nationwide house price index, you know, the biggest drop in a decade, albeit it's a month-on-month figure, so it's 1%. So, but Persimmon's pricing, you know, currently I think pricing forward sold 2,800 this year, which is less than half than of its kind of expected already massively slashed number of completions for this year. So, you know, not. Necessarily going to guide pricing for the full year, but the forward sold pricing was 6% higher than last year, and those assumptions we talked about, cost inflation and volumes, things like that, are predicated on flat pricing for Persimmon at least over the year. So there is room for disappointment there, albeit at the same time, Chief Exec I think did say about the predictions in general that they think that's going to be the floor and there are opportunities for bettering it.
But the operating margin is still sort of dependent on it's very difficult to sort of take a sort of worst case scenario or a floor sort of in at the moment because of the sort of variety of predictions out there. I mean, you've got sort of on a more bullish prediction, you've got Knight Frank saying house prices might drop 6% this year and then 4% the year after that. Japanese bank Nomura is saying 15% by mid 2024. So, those are quite wildly different ways of looking at it. Bloomberg is predicting a 30% peak to trough drop in real terms when inflation is factored in, which begs the question as to how much inflation will be. So, I suppose there are too many variables at play for it to make those
for the floor to be, exactly. Be in definitively. Yeah. Well, we've spoken about the housing market, of course, before on the podcast. This is a UK podcast, so why wouldn't we? But you know, about the potential, you know, for just a vacuum in transactions as well. And I think some of these figures from Persimmon show that wouldn't necessarily hide a lot of the pain given cost inflation and building requirements. But let's talk about the valuation of the company in particular. Peel Hunt, for example, said that, you know, consensus expectations need to come down by about 20% for this year based on what Persimmon said yesterday. The shares were off 9% on these results as well. Yet the company's still, you know, relatively expensive compared with peers. It is still slightly above book value, which, you know, you could say below book value is a buy call, but, you know, a lot of house builders are at that level. Persimmon isn't. We have them on a sale, you know, possibly for some of these reasons.
Yeah, I think that's the other thing as well is, you know, and it might sound like I'm being unduly harsh on Persimmon, but you have to understand the sort of sell call in the context of all of the other listed house builders. And I'm not saying they're all having a party, but, you know, there are other house builders that arguably are better investment cases right now. Very timely, Taylor Wimpey, as of the time of recording, came out with its results today. And it is looking like a healthier house builder, both going forward and with regards to its pricing. So they're not directly comparable, but they're pretty comparable as national house builders. I think if I were to sort of pinpoint one reason for Taylor Wimpey's better performance, I think it comes down to the price point. Taylor Wimpey develops houses. Last year, its average home, I mean, just in the UK, because it has operations in Spain, but its average home sold for £352,000, which is a lot more than obviously the average home. Wealthier buyers tend to buy with more cash and less debt, so their operations will be less impacted. Also, they'll be less impacted by the end of Help to Buy because they tend to aim at that higher price point. Whereas Persimmon, it builds houses for a lower price point, and it is much more dependent on Help to Buy than a lot of its peers. So, I think that those are the key differences there. And yeah, I suppose our advice to readers would be if you want to, you know, if we were to, there are other house builders, I suppose, with better investment cases is suppose the point of it.
Oh, our recommendation, not advice. You mentioned Help to Buy, and Persimmon, as you'd expect, you know, obviously got a big tailwind from that in recent years, as you discuss. And you know, again, Chief Exec Dean Finch was, I think, quite keen to emphasise that, you know, well, next year is an election year, so who knows what could happen there. Of course, this is the dynamic we see with the housing market. General UK prosperity, it's not unthinkable to conclude the government might want to do something next year, but we'll have to wait and see on that point.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's, I think the issue with that is, I mean, I don't think Persimmon is necessarily depending on the government to do something, but I don't think that's, I'm not saying it's not realistic. I'm just saying it's so wildly unpredictable. The government is also, in terms of what the government can do, the government's already done about as much as it can do. And also it ended Help to Buy. I think that showed a very clear direction of travel. I don't think there's much it could do that would benefit the house builders in terms of sort of propping up the housing market. I think they're kind of done with that. I don't know if it's the vote winner that Persimmon sort of wants, not to turn this into a politics podcast, but I don't think it's the vote winner that Persimmon expects it to be. And the sort of scheme they've got to replace it, deposit on lock, is it's not directly comparable as a scheme. And I think there's still, I suppose what I'm saying is there's still massive questions around that 20% of their revenue and what's going to happen to that, whether those people will just stop buying homes or whether they might choose to buy homes without Help to Buy or without any scheme or some mix of the two. I suppose there are too many variables is the issue. Mm. When 20% of your revenue was Help to Buy, you create, and then Help to Buy is ending, and you're going into a downturn and no one can predict the size of that downturn, and you've got build cost inflation, there are far too many variables to then put a sensible price on them.
Yeah. I said we wouldn't deliberate over the housing market itself much longer, but I have remembered that, Alex, you have just put your flat on the market. So maybe you have some, you know, an anecdotal insight for us or some thoughts on that.
Yeah, I suppose with the reminder that the plural of anecdote isn't data,
of course,
or any kind of forecast. I mean, why my case is so phenomenally interesting is that we put it on the market last year and then had to take it off. And now a year later gives us an insight into both how estate agents' bullishness might be lagging events and also just general interest levels. So, you know, without sort of labouring the specifics of my own particular situation, I mean, my sense at the moment is that, and I kind of understand a little bit where the house builders are coming from, is that until recently you had this dynamic where everything was steadily climbing, and actually that was a relatively happy pact for most in the market, buyer, seller or developer, assuming, of course, and huge assumption there, you can get a deposit to enter the market in the first place. But I mean, now, because the cost of cost of debt is so much higher. You know, seller, buyer, developer is thinking so much more about timing. And you got this commentary from the house builders this week, you know, this wait and see approach. That is rational. There's a very rational reason for adopting a wait and see approach if you're just going to be earning a far lower return on your capital while you're waiting for prices to find their floor, and you know, developers are looking to maximize the returns. But you know, that amplifies the swing in the market, and you know, in a sense, it's sort of making things arguably more difficult. You know, the question as to whether the developers will eventually see the light and just lower prices wholesale is another question entirely. I suspect they probably won't though.
How confident are you achieving your desired price for your home, Alex? I don't want specifics, but
No. Well, okay. Well, I can give you them roughly. I mean, so that it's currently on the market for 7% below what the estate agent said was viable about 10 months ago. But I think if we got 5% below the current asking price, so that's 11% down in a year in a borough. You know, and it's a London flat. It's not hugely expensive relative to other things you can see in the market or nearby. So that's an 11% drop, and that's not even in real terms. So I think, and I would be happy with that, to be honest. So I think we're already getting into double digits, or high double digit real return falls on viable transactions. So yeah, I mean, I think people are just going to have to adjust. It's just where we are.
Yeah. The final thing on Persimmon, which I suspect may only be of interest to me, but I did find it a little interesting as well, is they're quite keen to talk about their timber factory, which is still quite a few years out, I think, from coming online. But this is it would enable them to build another 7,000 timber frame homes a year, they say, when it does eventually happen. Timber being more energy efficient, so you know, it helps in that regard. And it was just quite interesting to me in what that might herald for UK building. Obviously, there are all these targets which we're not hitting and are even less likely to hit this year as house builders build less. But, you know, the difference in the UK compared with the US, where almost everything is timber and, you know, they seem to have generally be a bit better at building than we are. Of course, a lot of that is planning. I'm not saying it's all down to material, but it's just quite interesting to think of that change. I think, you know, timber is currently 25% of new builds. Could it end up being, you know, could we see a completely different type of house when we look back 3-4 decades from now?
Well, I mean, we can turn this into an industry podcast if you want, but yeah, timber, I suppose it is an interesting one. I mean, it's sort of, I think it's struggled to sort of get off the ground as a viable development material in the UK in commercial and in residential real estate for sort of several years. And then I think the memories in the shadow of Grenfell don't help with that. I think people are very, very wary of a material which is flammable or more flammable or could be more flammable, even with its myriad of other benefits. Now, house builders would be quick to say there's a lot you can do to timber. It seems counterintuitive to say this, but there's a lot you can do to sort of various types of wood and the way you build with it to make sure, even in sort of taller buildings, to make sure that it's not a tinderbox, essentially. But yeah, it's also, I imagine, it most certainly does have a lot to do with sort of their aims to be greener as well. It's widely seen as a sort of greener and more energy efficient material, not just in terms of the sort of operational efficiency, but in the sort of the embodied carbon that goes with, so is in the energy used to create timber, sort of is a big factor. It also speaks volumes to sort of how little house building has changed over the decades when you compare it to sort of other businesses, say ITV, for example, to go all the way back to the start of all this. ITV is making all of these radical changes with ITVX and everything else, and the way that it it does broadcasting and broadcasting technology. Meanwhile, Persimmon is saying we might build a timber factory, even though, as you pointed out, that's been the case in the US for years. So it's also interesting, I think, because it speaks to sort of how slow-moving this business is because of how fundamentally the technology of construction hasn't really changed. But yeah, who knows? It could be a big factor going forward. Yeah. But
well, as I said, it's a way off yet. I think they've submitted the planning application for the what they call a state-of-the-art factory. So
well, they would say that
we'll be discussing this in 2026. But I will say that the factory is apparently going to be built in Leicestershire, my home county. So possibly a great bit of news for the regional economy there. Who knows?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that does bring us to the end of today's show, though. So thank you very much to Mitch and to Alex and to Gemma, and thank you to you for listening. We'll be back next week with another Companies and Markets show.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.